From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
No matter where she lives, who she is, or what she does, a woman should never need her partner's permission to save her own life.
Microsoft founder Bill Gates speaking at the 16th International World AIDS Conference in Toronto, Canada, the largest conference on AIDS ever held. We'll spend the hour speaking with activists from around the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanese troops have begun entering South Lebanon after reaching a compromise deal over Hezbollah's presence in the region. More than 15,000 Lebanese troops are expected as part of a contingent that will stretch to the border with Israel. Hezbollah has agreed to drastically scale back its visible armed presence in the south, but will be allowed to maintain access to its operation centers and weaponry. Lebanon's death toll continues to rise as more bodies are recovered from the rubble of destroyed homes and buildings. Robert Fisk of the London Independent reports workers found 61 bodies Wednesday, bringing Lebanon's toll to almost 1,300 people. Democracy Now!'s Anna Nogueira is in Lebanon. She recently visited Bint Jebel, where she spoke to Nabil Bedoun. He had only recently returned to Lebanon from the United States when his town came under attack.
And I was a barren alive. For 1 week, no food, no water, nothing. And I'll be thanks to my neighbors. I was a kid. I used to give him $1 a day because he helped me if I want anything from the village. And he go, he picked it up for me. When he see my house, and he went, he called for help, and he think I'm a dead. They started digging, and they find me alive. My sister alone. She's burying alive with her kids, 7 kids and a husband. And even my wife's brother, his name Hassan Awada, he killed with 2 babies. They still they can't pick their kids. I felt those kids is mine. I used to play with them every day. I missed them.
Lebanese-American Nabil Bedoun speaking with Democracy Now!'s Anna Nogueira, who also visited the border village of Ain al-Shab. She spoke to a farmer who gave his name as Yasun.
All the farms now, it's burned. And all the people work in the farms now, they didn't have any job. They're waiting now to be construction the village, construction the farms, and they're starting to do the work. Those people, you saw it, they were all sleeping at the street. Because they don't have house, they don't have camps, they don't have a room, they don't have even the water to wash his hand.
Meanwhile, aid and human rights groups have launched an appeal for an international effort to clear out unexploded bombs they say are putting thousands of Lebanese at risk. This is Suha Abusat of UNICEF.
Now, perhaps the most immediate danger awaiting the returnees, as Astrid has said it, are the large number of unexploded missiles and other munitions that have been found across the country. It is estimated that 10% of this munition did not explode, and this is creating a really major risk problem.
As military control is transferred to the Lebanese government, Hezbollah is now vowing to focus on relief efforts. This is Hezbollah's South Lebanon leader, Nabil Kawouk.
After the enemy was defeated and their aggression failed, victory for us was reached. In response to an appeal by Hassan Nasrallah, we announce our victory against Israel and declare the start of cleanup efforts following Israel's aggression.
Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has pledged new furniture and a year's worth of rent to some 15,000 families whose homes were destroyed. The funding will come from Iran. The Wall Street Journal is reporting Lebanese aid officials are complaining over a lack of funding from the U.S. government. Lebanon's reconstruction is expected to cost upwards of $7 billion, but the Bush administration has promised just $50 million. Officials say the administration has also delayed aid transfers. The U.S. State Department waited 2 weeks before declaring the war a humanitarian emergency after clashes broke out last month. Lebanon's Interior Minister, Ahmad Fatfat, said, quote, "The Americans ask us to do a lot, and they don't help us to do it, which is so different from what the Iranians have done to help Hezbollah." Meanwhile, many aid agencies are reporting they've failed to reach their fundraising goals. The World Food Program says it's raised less than half the $21 million it needs to provide aid to Lebanon. Last week, The Washington Post reported Arab and Muslim American charities have also been receiving less donations for Lebanon. Leaders said the slowdown could be attributed in part to fears over the U.S. government's crackdown on Arab and Muslim charities. Meanwhile, in Israel, a new poll shows declining support for the two top Israeli leaders behind the attack on Lebanon. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's approval rating has fallen to 40%, down from nearly 80% at the height of the war. Defense Minister Amir Peretz has also seen his rating fall by more than half to below 30%. In Iraq, four people were killed and 12 injured earlier today when a car bomb exploded in the Sadr City section of Baghdad. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting of a growing consensus inside the U.S. military. The Iraq insurgency is getting stronger. According to the Pentagon, July saw the highest monthly total of roadside bombs since the start of the war. The number of daily strikes against U.S. and Iraqi security forces has doubled since the start of the year. A senior Pentagon official said the insurgency, quote, has gotten worse by almost all measures, with insurgent attacks at historically high levels. The official added the insurgency has more public support and more available fighters than at any point in time. The attacks are increasingly targeting U.S. troops. 518 soldiers were wounded in attacks last month, up from less than 300 in January. And of more than 1,600 bombs that exploded in July, more than two-thirds were directed at the U.S.-led occupation force. One military consultant with ties to the White House said the Bush administration is considering plans for the possibility Iraq's elected government might not survive. The expert said the plans include alternatives other than democracy. Meanwhile, a U.S. Marine officer has been charged with assaulting three Iraqi civilians. Military prosecutors say Lieutenant Nathan Fan beat and choked the Iraqis and placed his gun in one of the victims' mouths. The alleged incident took place in the town of Hamdaniyah in April. Lieutenant Fan was the platoon leader for the troops who've been charged with the killing of an Iraqi man there, but he has not been charged in that case. In Britain, a judge has ruled police have until next week to detain 23 suspects arrested in the alleged plot to blow up 10 airplanes bound for the United States. On Wednesday, Home Secretary John Reid said some of the suspects would likely not be charged with major crimes, but vowed indictments for others he says were deeply involved. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is reporting Pakistani intelligence officials are discounting the U.S. government's claim the alleged plot was the work of al-Qaeda. According to the officials, the suspects were, quote, too inexperienced to carry out the plan. They said the suspects are not known to have attended training camps in Afghanistan or Pakistan. They're also believed to have learned about making bombs by reading textbooks. In other news from Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair is facing a potential row over the reported comments of Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott on the Bush administration. According to the London Independent, Prescott told a gathering of Labour parliamentarians this week he believes White House policy for the Middle East is, quote, crap. Prescott is also quoted as saying President Bush is, quote, just a cowboy with his Stetson on. Prescott denies making the comments. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is warning the humanitarian crisis in Darfur is worsening by the day. Half of Darfur's civilians are completely cut off from humanitarian aid. Accessing the other half is fraught with risk. Villagers are fleeing in massive numbers, reporting indiscriminate killings, rape, and abduction. The situation has worsened since the rebels reached a peace agreement with the Sudanese government in May. Fighting has increased between them, while the Sudanese-backed militias have stepped up attacks on humanitarian workers and UN troops. Here in the United States, a new government-commissioned report is warning of severe electoral problems in Ohio's most populous county. According to the Election Science Institute, problems in Cuyahoga County are so widespread, it's unlikely they'll be fixed by November or even by the next presidential election. The report singles out voting machines manufactured by the company Diebold. Poll workers have had difficulty operating the machines. Absentee ballots have gone uncounted, and the machines' vote totals have not added up. The lawyer for outed CIA operative Valerie Plame is vowing to force Vice President Dick Cheney ex-chief of staff Louis Scooter Libby and presidential adviser Karl Rove to testify in Plame's civil lawsuit against them. Plame filed the suit last month, accusing the three of conspiring to end her career and putting her and her family at risk. She was outed as a CIA operative shortly after her husband, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, went public with findings challenging one of the Bush administration's pre-war claims on Iraqi weapons. Plame's attorney, Joseph Kotchett, says he will invoke a 1997 Supreme Court ruling in Paula Jones' sexual harassment case against President Bill Clinton. According to Kotchett, the ruling establishes a precedent that would grant the accused White House officials immunity only if they could prove they were acting on government business when they leaked Plame's name to the media. In military news, the U.S. has announced it'll double the number of missile defense ships in the Pacific Ocean. The military says these ships are needed to protect the U.S. from potential missile strikes from North Korea or Iran. In New Orleans, a group of more than 80 immigrant hotel workers have filed a lawsuit against the prominent U.S. chain Decatur Hotels. The workers were recruited from Peru, Bolivia, and the Dominican Republic to take maintenance and support jobs in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina under promises of high wages and steady work. But they say Decatur has withheld travel reimbursements and overtime pay. In Colombia, the government has announced it's used U.S.-supplied planes for the first time to fumigate a national park where rebels and farmers have grown coca, the raw ingredient for cocaine. The government says it cleared more than 11,000 acres. The spraying took place over the challenges of environmentalists and local groups. They've accused the government of endangering the environment and putting thousands of local residents at risk. And finally, this news from Paraguay. The former dictator, Alfredo Stroessner, has died at the age of 93. Stroessner seized power in 1954 and held on to power for 35 years. He provided a haven to several Nazi war criminals, including Dr. Joseph Mengele, known as the Angel of Death at Auschwitz. Stroessner was a staunch ally of the U.S. government. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 24,000 scientists, activists, and officials are gathering in Toronto, Canada this week for the 16th International World AIDS Conference, the largest conference on AIDS ever held. An estimated 25 million people have died of AIDS since the first cases of HIV were reported a quarter of a century ago. Today, we'll spend the hour speaking with activists from around the world. We'll hear why a coalition of African-American groups are calling on Black America to renew its efforts to fight AIDS and homophobia. We'll look at why the countries hit hardest by AIDS need millions more medical workers. And we'll hear why many at the conference, including Microsoft founder Bill Gates, have criticized the Bush administration's ABC policy of abstinence, be faithful, and use a condom. We'll speak with a leading advocate for sex workers in Canada. Earlier this week, the World Health Organization warned that the countries hit hardest by AIDS desperately need 4 million more health workers to cope with the crisis. These countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, are suffering from what's known as a brain drain. Many of the locally trained doctors and nurses have been lured away to the United States and Europe by higher salaries. In South Africa, a third of locally trained doctors are now working outside the country. In one section of Uganda, half of the doctors recently trained in handling HIV have left the country to work at NGOs in the region. Smita Baruch joins us from Toronto, where she's attending the 16th International World AIDS Conference. She is the Senior Government Affairs Manager for Physicians for Human Rights. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk about this crisis of medical workers leaving the country's hardest hit by AIDS?
Yes. You know, one of the things that's been great about this conference is that the issue of the lack of healthcare workers has been really highlighted in many different ways, through sessions, through white coats and balloons, through press conferences. 2 years ago in Bangkok, this issue was rarely discussed, and now it has become a central focus of this conference. Right now, sub-Saharan Africa, that's facing the highest AIDS epidemic, needs 1 million more health workers. workers in order to combat this crisis. As you said, doctors are leaving countries like Uganda, Rwanda, Tanzania, Malawi. In the entire country of Malawi, Malawi can right now only treat 1% of those infected with HIV and AIDS, 1% of more than a million, many millions of Malawians who are affected by AIDS right now. And there are many factors contributing to this. One is certainly doctors leaving the countries for better opportunities in the United States, Canada, the UK. And we are also part of that problem. We have not increased our own training capacity for nurses and doctors, and have turned away over 150,000 nursing applicants because we don't have the capacity to take them in our own universities. And then we try to solve that problem by bringing in more doctors and nurses and health professionals from these countries who probably need them more than we do in some respects. And other factors are also contributing. Many of these places, they have to work in unsafe working conditions. Treatment is not available for healthcare workers themselves. They also leave because their training doesn't match. They are trained in Western-style medical schools, and then they go to a rural community, and it's very different from what they've been trained to do and learned to do. And so we must look at the way health professionals are trained in these countries. We must do some skill transfers. World Health Organization has talked about what they call transfer of skills, or using lower cadre of health workers, training community health workers, so that they can do some of the jobs of doctors and nurses and do some of the treatment and the care.
Now, you also, Smita, have the issue of health workers themselves getting AIDS, is that right, and HIV?
That's correct. And that's part of the unsafe working conditions, is that they're not protected right now. Sometimes they don't have access to the treatment and or prevention. A lot of them are afraid to disclose that they are HIV positive, and therefore don't seek treatment because they are afraid of losing their jobs. And so one of the things that we and other organizations are trying to focus on is getting the treatment for healthcare workers themselves.
I'm looking at the World Health Organization report, Treat, Train, Retain, which looks at skilled medical workers in Africa who have been lured abroad, ironically, most often by the United States and Europe. Explain exactly how that happens.
Sometimes they're lured by the financial opportunities. They're lured. For instance, in our own country, we had a provision included in the immigration bill that's being debated right now in U.S. Congress that lifts the cap, the number of immigrant nurses that can come to this country. And by doing that, taking away nurses from the Caribbean, from African countries. We provide incentives for them to come here, and we're not advocating that they don't have the right to leave their countries for better opportunities. But we do recruit from abroad. We do and change laws in our own immigration to allow more doctors and nurses to come in. And part of that is that's how we try to solve our own problems of, many rural communities in the U.S. are also facing healthcare worker shortages. Many urban areas in Chicago, Chicago on the south side, a hospital had to almost close because they didn't have enough doctors and nurses. And the way we try to solve that problem is just by bringing doctors and nurses from countries like Africa, and rather than trying to come up with our own strategy, rather than investing more in our own nursing and medical schools, we lure. We, you know, provide incentives and through immigration laws and through recruitment abroad, we try to bring in health professionals from elsewhere. And what we think that industrialized nations should do, we acknowledge that, yes, we are also facing a crisis of our own in our own countries, but the way to solve that is not by robbing doctors and nurses from other countries. We really need to empower our own doctors and nurses and, you know, admit more nurses and doctors into medical and nursing schools and really have own domestic strategies.
Finally, Smita, can you describe what role this conference plays in dealing with these issues? I mean, how effective is it? You're now in Toronto. We're spending the hour there at this, the largest international AIDS conference ever held in the world, the 16th annual one. How do these issues get dealt with in Toronto at the conference?
I think in several ways. I think that by raising this in plenary sessions, in breakout sessions, with our international colleagues, we are able to come up with a joint. It provides an opportunity for a joint movement towards addressing these issues. It puts pressure on donor governments and country governments to come up with plans. That is what we're trying to do at this conference, is trying to keep the pressure up. If they are committed to combating the AIDS crisis, they must look at the lack of health professionals in these countries, and by raising it at international conferences such as this one, this is the place where we can put the maximum pressure. And working with our colleagues, we have many delegates from Africa. Physicians for Human Rights has sponsored doctors from Kenya and Uganda, and a medical student who have spoken. They have spoken with, they met with Mark Dybul, the U.S. office, the office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, yesterday, and spoke with him about this issue. They have spoken to the press about this issue, and those are the ways that you can use this conference and the delegates to really join forces and finding ways to address this issue and really have a joint pressure on their own governments and the donor governments as well.
Smita Brewer, I want to thank you very much for being with us, of the Physicians for Human Rights. She is in Toronto, Canada now for the 16th Annual International AIDS Conference, and we'll stay there through the whole show. We'll go to break first.
Bamboo for AIDS, my brothers. This disease, they're for real. Think of me.
Femi Kuti, Stop AIDS. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, we are spending the hour in Toronto, Canada, for the 16th International AIDS Conference. The NAACP, the National Urban League, and other civil rights groups have launched a major new effort to fight AIDS and homophobia within the African-American community. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 650,000 African-Americans now have AIDS. This represents more than half the AIDS cases in the United States. On Monday, NAACP Chair Julian Bond, actress Cheryl Lee Ralph, filmmaker Bill Duke, and Congressmember Maxine Waters and Barbara Lee gathered in Toronto to back a national call to action and declaration of commitment to end the AIDS epidemic in Black America. Spearheading the initiative is the Black AIDS Institute. The group's founder and executive director is Phil Wilson. He's from Los Angeles, joins us now in the studio in Toronto. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you with us. First, Phil, before we talk about this initiative that you've spearheaded, can you describe the scene in Toronto, where you are now, how this conference is actually happening, what it looks like and feels like?
Well, we're at the Toronto Convention Center right now. We're actually in the Global Village area. It's an area that has extended the reach of the conference to include the entire community of Toronto, in fact, all of Canada. It's a part of the conference where whether you're registered or not, you can participate. There's workshops, there's symposiums, there's all sorts of ways to interact with the delegates.
Can you talk about the initiative that you're spearheading?
Well, you know, we're 25 years into this epidemic, and in the intervening years since Dr. Michael Gottlieb identified this strange disease among five of his white gay male patients, now AIDS is no longer white, no longer gay, no longer predominantly male. And in America today, AIDS is a Black disease. No matter how you look at it through the lens of gender or sexual orientation or age or socioeconomic class or age education or region of the country where you live, Black folks bear the brunt of the epidemic. As you said, in the lead, and 650,000 Black Americans are now living with AIDS more than ever before. Nearly 50% of all Americans living with AIDS. We represent 54% of the new HIV/AIDS cases in the country. Among young people, that number is 63%. Among women, it's a shocking nearly 70%. The CDC released data last year implying that quite possibly nearly 50% of Black gay and bisexual men in some of our urban cities may already be HIV positive. To put that into context in this global forum, there is no place else on the planet where we see HIV rates approaching 50%. And so what we're saying is enough already. Now, we're 25 years into this. Do we need to go another 25 years where the only place you'll find Black people are in places called the Colored Museum? And so now Black leaders all over America are making a declaration of commitment and asking for a call to action. We're committing to reversing the AIDS epidemic in Black America in the next 5 years.
Phil Wilson, how did you get involved with this issue?
Well, actually, the issue got involved in me. I've been living with HIV for 25 years, full-blown AIDS for 15 years. In 1981, I went to my doctor, and he saw his swollen lymph nodes, and he had read this MMWR, and it talked about swollen lymph nodes. At that time, he took a biopsy. There wasn't really any information. 2 weeks later, one of my friends who played on a baseball team with me was dead, you know, and we were off to the races.
Did you say 1981?
1981, yes.
A quarter of a century ago.
Basically half of my life. Now, I don't remember not living with HIV at this point. And over the last 25 years, I've lost count of how many of my friends and loved ones who died from the disease, including my first partner of 10 years, Chris Brownlee, countless friends like Reggie Williams. You know, at one point, every photograph in my house where there was more than one person, if I was in the photograph, I was the only person left alive. I don't want to see that continue. I have two children who are now young adults, and I think that we have a responsibility to make sure that our children and our children's children don't have to deal with this.
And Phil Wilson, you yourself living with HIV, how do you maintain your health?
Well, I maintain my health because I have the love and support of family and friends. I have unconditional love of my parents and my siblings. I have access to the best health care the planet has to offer. But I am the exception to the rule. Most people who look like me, whether or not they live in Soweto or South Central Los Angeles, or they live in Johannesburg, you know, or don't have access to the best health care, they often don't have access to the love and support of family and friends. We still get calls from young people who just found out that they're HIV positive, you know, who don't know what to do, who are more afraid of the stigma than they are of the disease. We still get calls from Black mothers who are dealing with the grief and the guilt of having lost a child to HIV and AIDS, who they could not reconcile the fact that they discarded that child, they rejected that child, and they never had a chance to mend those relationships.
Phil Wilson, AIDS is now the top national cause of death for African American women between the ages of 25 and 34. I think most people would be surprised in this country to learn this. Julian Bond, chair of the NAACP, pledges to make AIDS the next chapter in the NAACP's decades of advocacy for access to quality health care among African Americans. When you come back from Toronto, exactly how is this going to happen?
Well, a number of ways. First of all, we've set specific, measurable goals and objectives. Our goal number one is to dramatically reduce the HIV/AIDS rate in Black America, to increase the percentage of African Americans living with HIV who know their HIV status. It's estimated between 25 and 50% of Americans living with HIV don't even know it. That number is probably higher in Black America. To increase the number of people who are in early, appropriate HIV treatment and care. National civil rights organizations, national fraternities and sororities, national organizations all over America are called to do a number of things, including hire and appoint a national AIDS coordinator in their organization, to set out a five-year strategic action plan that they evaluate every year, to set out national HIV testing goals and objectives every year, to incorporate HIV messages in their national gatherings, in their communication mechanisms like their websites and their newspapers, to incorporate HIV and AIDS in their policy agenda. So they're talking about it in their advocacy efforts. You know, basically what we're saying is there a role for the government to play? Absolutely. Is our government playing the role it should be playing? Absolutely not. Is there a role for corporations to be playing? Absolutely. Are corporations doing their part? Absolutely not. But at the end of the day, we still have to survive. I refuse to believe that we survived the Middle Passage, 300 years of slavery, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, Bull Connor, the LAPD, only to let HIV take us out. It won't happen that way. And Black people are committed to saving ourselves.
Phil Wilson, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of the Black AIDS Institute. Your website for people who want to get more information.
www.blackaids.org. And our telephone number is 213-353-3610.
And we will post all that on our website at democracynow.org. Next up, we're going from African America to Africa, to South Africa. And we'll speak with Sifo Matati in South Africa, usually now in Toronto for the 16th International AIDS Conference. But first, a break with Spearhead. It's called Positive.
Life if I'm positive, is it gonna be a negative?
positive, Michael Franti and Spearhead. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. We will be speaking with Sifo Matati of South Africa in just a few minutes. But first, on Sunday at the International AIDS Conference in Toronto, Microsoft founder Bill Gates gave a keynote address about the fight against AIDS, and he criticized the Bush administration's push for abstinence policies. Gates said the ABC program, promoting abstinence, being faithful, and using a condom, has saved many lives, but that the power to prevent HIV must be put in the hands of women.
We need to put the power to prevent HIV in the hands of women. So we need tools that will allow women to protect themselves. This is true whether the woman is the faithful married mother of small children or a sex worker trying to scrape out a living in a slum. No matter where she lives, who she is, or what she does, a woman should never need her partner's permission to save her own life.
Microsoft founder Bill Gates. To talk more about HIV prevention, two AIDS activists join us in Toronto. Julie Davids is the executive director of the Community HIV-AIDS Mobilization Project in New York City. And Claire Tabuteau is the executive director of Stella, a sex workers' rights group based in Montreal. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Julie Davids. Talk about what you think are the key issues around prevention.
I think what's key in HIV prevention is holding paramount that we have to keep the sex and drugs in the forefront of HIV prevention. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is this mischaracterization that we can somehow segregate prevention information so that some people get incomplete information. For example, if you're married and living in Africa, the notion that you just need to hear about abstinence and being faithful, when in fact what you need is access to condoms because your partner has other partners and you need to be able to protect yourself. Further, we need to be able to have innovations in HIV prevention around sex and drugs that allow people to have a level of control that they themselves can control. So microbicides or other interventions that women could use, that could be a cream or a gel that could prevent HIV/AIDS, is not something they have to try to get on their male partner. And indeed, men and women worldwide need a microbicide for rectal use because we have an undercounting of rectal sex. And so these details of HIV prevention issues must be attended to through better research and better policies and fundamentally rooted in the human rights of people to have full access to HIV prevention and tools and honest discussion of sexuality and drug use.
What are the latest therapies, medical therapies, that are being talked about at this, the largest international AIDS conference ever held in the world?
Well, there's a range of therapies that are being talked about, and what we're seeing is a blurring of the lines between treatment and prevention. So, for example, we're looking at research on the use of antiretroviral drugs, not just for people who are HIV positive, but could they be given as a form of preventive therapies? Comparable in some ways to a birth control pill, that if people know that they are at risk and they are unable for whatever reason to protect themselves in other ways, would a daily dose of an anti-HIV drug give them protection that they need? We're seeing on the one hand a next generation of HIV/AIDS drugs that will be available in the West and in wealthy countries as people are facing resistance or to simplify therapies so you take them less often or have less side effects. And the contentious issue here has been, are these treatments going to start to reach around the world? So, for example, less toxic therapies or those that don't require refrigeration and the next generation of AIDS drugs, are they going to reach people in a timely fashion? Are we going to go through another decades of delay for people have to continue to fight in the streets for access to the latest HIV therapies, even as we try to extend the reach of therapies worldwide?
Julie Davids, how many international AIDS conferences have you attended?
I've been to five.
Can you talk about whether you see a progression, what kinds of changes you see from one to the next?
Indeed, and I think the changes are fascinating. I want to reinforce that the Global Village, which is an opportunity here at the conference for the public to be able to participate, it's a wonderful innovation that started 2 years ago at the last International AIDS Conference that creates one world with many worlds, as the Zapatistas would say, people being able to create their own communities on site, open to all. And that's what we need to see more of in HIV/AIDS efforts worldwide, community-controlled space that allows people to determine for themselves what's needed with the resources they need to bring it to scale. The conferences have become much larger. We've also seen them become celebritized. And I think what we've seen here, for example, in terms of our own government, we have a former head of state who's very much a celebrity. We have Bill Gates, who's a private leader. But what we don't have is current heads of state from the United States. And it's our understanding that top U.S. officials have not come to the conference understanding how much anger there is about the suppression of information on HIV prevention, about wrong-headed drug policies promulgated by the U.S. worldwide. They're not going to be able to take the heat, and they've stayed out of the kitchen. Some of the U.S. officials who are here, when pressed, will say they disagree with the U.S. government's own policies, and many others who are able to be here, despite a pretty widespread ban in government participation at this conference, including many government scientists who need the dialogue with their colleagues, many will say, I am very opposed to what's going on, but I can't speak out for fear of losing my job.
Hmm. We're talking to Julie David in Toronto right now, executive director of the Community HIV AIDS Mobilization Project, National HIV AIDS Policy. When you talk about suppression of information, what exactly do you mean?
One of the first things that happened when the Bush administration came to Washington was they took down the fact sheet about condoms from the Centers for Disease Control website. It was just disappeared. And when it came back up, the information had changed. And it implied that condoms don't work. There's also a website, forparents.gov, that they've put up that is supposed to help parents talk with their adolescent children about tough issues, stigmatized issues. And it has a lot of misinformation about HIV. It only talks about the failure rates of contraception and HIV prevention, not the success rates. We've managed to change some of the very biased information about gay youth on the site. That's some of the suppression that has happened. And the ban on U.S. government researchers, they say there's only about 175 researchers and other U.S. government people at this conference out of 24,000. This conference is not a junket. It's tiring. You have to walk a far way to sessions. But it's really important to be able to talk with people from around the world to further our fight against HIV/AIDS. And banning researchers from coming to the conference is a de facto suppression of information.
And on that issue, one of the criterion for the Gates to give money, of which they have billions, is that scientists have to share the information. What exactly does that mean?
Well, in a time of shrinking funding for research, we've seen, for example, funding at the National Institutes of Health not keep pace with inflation. There's intense competition for research dollars. And this can lead to scientists actually kind of hoarding information rather than working in a collaborative fashion. And we've seen that the best way to reach answers is collaboration and cross-discipline collaboration. So we commend the Gates for their insistence in collaboration between scientists. And we'd like to stress that even as we look for biomedical approaches to prevention, such as microbicides, such as the potential use of AIDS drugs to prevent HIV, we need to keep behavioral science in there. That is to say, how do humans deal with these prevention therapies? How do humans deal with treatment? What happens when you try and use it with your partner or with a series of partners? If you try and integrate your conception of am I at risk of HIV or not in trying to access these therapies? And the third area of collaboration we need is with the healthcare system itself. We believe that part of the reason that rates are so high in the African-American community in the United States gets back to simple lack of access to health care. For example, if you have a sexually transmitted disease that's not treated, it can facilitate HIV taking hold in your body if you're exposed. We know that people are marginalized from health care in the United States. We don't have a national health care system like our colleagues here in Canada, and especially in the rural South, where HIV rates are fast rising in African-American communities. There's very little access to culturally appropriate health care, and that means that people aren't able to get treatment for the other factors that can make them more vulnerable for HIV. So we need to have collaboration across science, across government, across social movements in research on technology, research on social behavior, and basic health care and other social supports and human rights if we're really going to get a hold of this escalating epidemic.
We're going to turn now to Claire Thibuteau, who is also in Toronto, former stripper and executive director of Stella, Sex Workers' Rights Group, which is based in Montreal. Can you talk about the key issues you see for sex workers in Canada?
Well, our message was quite simple, actually. It was, it's time to deliver. We took, again, the slogan of the conference. It's time to deliver sex workers, for sex workers, their human rights and their workers' rights in the fight against AIDS. As long as we can organize, have our work recognized as work, and have our work recognized as work in the labor code, having our work decriminalized, there's a lot of blocks, there's a lot of difficulties for us in this fight. In many countries, we had problem accessing condoms lately because of the Bush administration policies, for example, and this emphasis on abstinence and fidelity, which is, makes absolutely no sense for sex workers as long as we work. You know, we are far from abstinence. Or as a colleague of mine in Thailand, abstinence like is low season, translate into low season. So it doesn't make any sense for us having trouble accessing condoms, which is so such a simple and effective way to prevent HIV/AIDS. In with the Bush administration policies also, there's this pledge against prostitution that was put up to many organizations that was a block for us organizing or other organization giving services to sex workers that were not in favor of doing it anymore for the last 2 years because they feared repercussion and cutting from fundings. So it meant that in Bangladesh, for example, 18 of 20 drop-in centers that serve sex workers, where sex workers were going there before work, getting some condoms and sharing information together and, you know, for prevention of violence, etc., don't exist anymore. They have to. They had to close down, and so we need. I agree with Julia. Actually, we need the sex back into HIV/AIDS prevention. It's really harmful to us. Things are gonna get worse in the last 2 years, and then more than ever.
Claire, I wanted to ask you about your prime minister. This is the largest AIDS conference ever held anywhere in the world, and it's the 16th one. Your prime minister, Stephen Harper, did not come to the Canadian, to this conference that's taking place in Canada. Why not, and what's the response?
Julia mentioned it. There was no head of the U.S. government. There, I didn't see many people from the Canadian government, too, and especially Mr. Harper. Everybody was asking, where's Mr. Harper? Well, for sure, we fear a lot of things coming from this conservative government. Actually, our funding right now in all the programs is we cannot sign anything after March 2008. And we're really like looking forward to get some answers about this with this government, because we really don't know. They have this evaluation and revision of all programs. The former prime minister promised to double the AIDS money for up to 2010, I think. But we haven't seen any of this. Well, like this year, we had a new program coming in that was replacing an old one. But we have this empty all of time, 9 months, where we have problem getting the funding.
Well, Claire, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Claire Thibuteau, former stripper, executive director of Stella, a sex workers' rights group based in Montreal. She, with Julie Davids of the Community HIV/AIDS Mobilization Project, is at the International Conference on AIDS. When we come back from break, we'll talk about AIDS in Africa, in South Africa specifically, with Sifo Matati. Stay with us. AIDS in Africa by Cass McCombs here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're spending the hour in Toronto, Canada at the 16th International AIDS Conference. Sifo Matati is with us, General Secretary of the South African AIDS activist group called Treatment Action Campaign. Sifo, it's good to have you back on Democracy Now! Can you talk about the scope of the problem in South Africa?
Well, I mean, I think the problem we continue to face in South Africa is what we call the total failure of government to lead a coordinated national response to what has presented itself as a catastrophe for the our new democracy. We currently have 800,000 people who need AIDS treatment. Our country does not have a plan to provide life-saving treatment to those people. On a daily basis, 1,500 new infections take place. Our country does not have a credible plan to prevent new infections. The impact of the epidemic is ravaging communities and households, and our country is not standing up to the crisis of the epidemic. And so we are calling for greater government leadership in dealing with what we call a national crisis.
Sifo, there was an action of your organization storming one of the tables in the exhibit hall. Can you explain why?
Well, I mean, we stormed the South African exhibition in the exhibition hall. And the reason we did that was twofold. One is we feel that the display of things like garlic and lemon juice and beetroot, which are very visibly displayed in the South African stand, is not only an insult to the pain and suffering of people with AIDS in our country, it is an insult to the crisis that our country faces. And that for the Minister of Health to come to an international platform like this and display such things, I think undermines our whole country in the eyes of the world. And I think it undermines and insults people with AIDS who are waiting for treatment, proven treatment today, and whom the minister continues to deny access to life-saving treatment because of her own denialism. And so we stormed the South African booth to demand greater leadership and a decisive action from our government. But also what has happened, which is also a demonstration of the failures of our country to provide access to people with AIDS, is that we had lodged in support of prisoners in a facility called Westville in Durban in South Africa, where 50 prisoners today are known to have CD4 counts less than 100, and those people need treatment urgently. And we had to go to court to force the government to provide life-saving treatment to those people. And instead of government providing the treatment, they have appealed the judgment. And that has led to the death of some of the prisoners. One of the prisoners died last week because he started treatment too late, and many of them are waiting, and the government does not have a plan to provide treatment to people in prisons in our country in the same way that it doesn't have a credible operational plan to provide treatment to the 800,000 people who need it today in our country.
Sifo Matati, how do U.S. policies affect South Africa?
Well, U.S. policy affects not only South Africa, it affects particularly all of the developing world. Activists from India have come to the conference, and they have been protesting the influence, particularly of U.S.-based drug companies, who, despite the flexibilities of the Doha Declaration in the area of public health and particularly antiretroviral drugs, U.S.-based companies particularly are pressurizing the Indian government to prevent the manufacture of much-needed generic versions of particularly second-line drugs, which for many of our countries are critical. And that policy, which is obviously backed by the U.S. government, of profiteering of U.S.-based and companies particularly, is affecting people. We know the history of the U.S. government in putting pressure on countries who have attempted, like Brazil, to exercise their rights and to use the flexibilities of the TRIPS agreement, including the issuing of voluntary licenses, and which would allow generic companies to produce the drugs to provide for the greater population in much more affordable ways. We've also seen activists, particularly from Latin America, lamenting the bilateral pressure that has come through the free trade agreements that the U.S. is pushing, particularly in South America, which is really hindering the power of governments to actually provide particularly treatment and to do the right thing to protect the health of their people. We also know that although the rest of the world acknowledges and appreciates the investment made by the U.S. government through PEPFAR, which is on the one hand saving lives, the ideological fundamentals which are being driven through the PEPFAR program, which deny access to services for drug users, for and harm reduction programs, and for sex workers, and which have the tendency to promote abstinence over comprehensive approaches to HIV prevention, are harming and undermining the very investment that the U.S. government has made through PEPFAR. And those are issues that we would like to bring to the attention of the U.S. government.
Sifa Mutati, one of the people who addressed the conference was Bill Gates, of course, founder of Microsoft, talking about how the control has to be given back to women in dealing with AIDS. How does the fact that these two people, Bill and Melinda Gates, have so much money, billions of dollars, often talking about issues in the same way you talk about them, affect the global landscape as they say they're going to pour those billions into dealing with issues like AIDS?
Well, I mean, our starting point as activists who are here and as people living with HIV is that we appreciate the commitment that has been displayed by philanthropists like Bill and Melinda Gates and as well as Bill Clinton. And we wish that there were more of those, particularly from the private sector, because we are really aggrieved that the private sector is not adequately coming to the table with the resources that we know it has. However, we are concerned, and this is a point we have made throughout this conference, that the hiding of the failures of governments to provide the necessary leadership in finding solutions to the global AIDS crisis cannot be hidden by philanthropists who rightfully, you know, provide assistance and who come to the table. And we have felt that at times the attention given and the voice given to philanthropists like Gates has tended to shadow the real practical difficulties which many people in the countries that we come from are struggling with, particularly the failures of government, national governments, to give leadership. But also we feel that, these grand announcements have the tendency also to allow the complacency that we have seen, we've seen it in our own country in South Africa, and we've seen it in other countries, to for governments to actually think big about how to address the epidemic. And then to say, you know, to the private sector, bring your resources and support us. But we are concerned that the leadership vacuum which, you know, governments have allowed is being filled by people who have good intentions and whose commitment we appreciate, but that it has the potential to allow and to, in fact, justify the failure of leadership by government.
Sifa Mutati, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us, General Secretary of the South African AIDS Activist Group Treatment Action Campaign, speaking to us from Toronto, Canada, the International AIDS Conference, the 16th, the largest in the world. That does it for our show. You can see the images of the conference and AIDS activism around the world at our website, democracynow.org. Produced by Mike Berkshire, for Doka Deuce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.